Matt Busby is director of the Camp House and pastor of cultural engagement for the Mission Chattanooga. In a podcast this month, he talked about systemic racism and Chattanooga's own history.
Matt, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on.
Tell us more about this episode of the Camp House podcast.
I mean, I don't think I can separate the episode that I created from so much of the learning that I've done both at the Camp House, you know, working with people in our community, as well as a lot of the hard work we've done within the Mission Chattanooga as part of our pastoral staff. I think the conversation around racial injustice and inequities and systemic racism is one that since Ferguson and since so many of the deaths of Black men at the hands of police and, you know, essentially white vigilantes for the past 3 or 4 years has really brought that conversation to the forefront within our own church and specifically among our pastoral staff. But also, you know, within the Camp House, you know, we've sought to use our resources and our stage to really give a voice to anybody who has something to contribute to the culture of our city. And through that, you know, I've made incredible relationships with Shane Morrow, Rise Chattanooga, and then, you know, individual artists like J Flo, Jeremy Lawrence, Cameron C. Grimey, who's leading a lot of the protests right now. Just so many different people through just running a venue in Chattanooga. It's kind of wild how it's come from different angles like that.
A lot of what you tell in this episode of the podcast is a history lesson. Not only the history that a lot of us thought we knew from a different angle, but a lot of history that was not conveyed to a lot of us.
Yeah. Well, yeah, including me. You know, I wasn't taught these things growing up. I mean, I grew up in a hometown. You know, my hometown was 2 hours from Tulsa, Oklahoma. I never heard about the Tulsa race riots until I was, I think, 25 years old, maybe 30. I didn't even hear it in college, and I was a history major in college. It's probably why I love this stuff so much, looking at the historical examples. And I should give the caveat that this is a 20-minute episode. You know, this is like a, I think I say it in the podcast, it's like a tip of an iceberg sort of episode. But yeah, I do think that from my experience of having this conversation specifically with white people to try and describe systemic racism and injustice or structural racism, kind of however you want to phrase it, if you don't understand the history of this, like you don't understand the current moment and how we got to this moment, you cannot understand why people are burning a Target or spending nights in a row out on the streets protesting this. You can't understand why this is a tipping point for so many of our African-American brothers and sisters across the country, as well as others.
Part of what you share is reframing, as I was saying just a moment ago, what we thought we knew, including what happened in the 1960s and the aftermath of what happened in the 1960s.
Yeah. Like I said, I've read a lot, and I think there's a burden in learning these kind of things, and it takes a lot of time. You know, fortunately, like I said, I think I started that journey maybe 4 years ago, and so finding different resources. In the podcast, I mentioned how we look at the Civil Rights Act of the 60s as this massive celebration of progress, and the integration of our schools, this is a great thing. But it was really Malcolm Gladwell's podcast that kind of opened my eyes to that piece. It wasn't anything I read in a book. You know, Malcolm Gladwell did a whole episode on how the end results of integrating our schools resulted in the job loss of like 70% of our African-American teachers. And it completely changed our school system for 50 years in a way that wasn't necessarily positive.
Another author, another thinker plays a role in your podcast, and that's Ibram X. Kendi, whom people have seen quite a bit of on the national stage lately because of his recent work and him appearing on television.
And I can't recommend Stamp from the Beginning enough. It's free on Spotify right now for people to go listen to. I mean, it's a massive, massive work because it is a history of racist ideas going all the way back to the Portuguese getting the first slaves from Africa, all the way up to today. What I love about Kendi's book too is he points out, you know, I'm a pastor. The church absolutely has a role in what's happened to African Americans in our country. But he points out everything did, right? It wasn't just theology at the time. The foundations of science are as rooted in systemic racism as the theology of the white church. And the banking system is as rooted in this problem as anybody else. And so he does a fantastic job in that book of not only just taking you through a history of this, of how we've had progress and then we step back, progress and then we step back. Like white supremacy finds its way, white privilege finds its way of reasserting itself every single time. That's not just in these big movements. You know, the foundation of so much of what we take for granted as a modern liberal democracy is equally rooted in structural racism that privileged certain people above others.
How, from your experience, have you seen this play out in the Chattanooga area? You are a recent arrival here, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
I'm more recent than you, but I'm curious, taking what you've learned, taking what you've read, taking what you've heard, but also coupling that with what you experience day to day getting out into the community.
I would be incredibly hesitant to say anything that is super contemporary just because I am white, and my experience of CPD, my experience of the structures of our city are obviously very, very, very different than if you grew up in Alton Park or something like that. But I will say the sort of systemic racism that is like that people hear about now and they think, how can people ever believe that or do that, is far more recent in Chattanooga's history than anybody wants to think about, right? So a book that I would recommend to everybody that is 100% local is a book called Constructing the Dynamo of Dixie, Race, Urban Planning, and Cosmopolitanism in Chattanooga by Courtney Knapp. And you can find it on Amazon. She's a professor now. This was essentially her PhD work. But she highlights these examples. And if you look at the 1970s, when we started integrating different city services, even just our park system, at the time, Chattanooga had two segregated parks. They had Warner Park, which was the white park, and they had Lincoln Park, which was the African-American park. And if you look at the history of Lincoln Park in Chattanooga, it's one of the most incredible African-American places in the entire South. Like, there was a baseball field with floodlights. They had an Olympic-sized pool. This was very, very unique. And it became a cultural center for the entire South, was this one African-American park in Chattanooga. Jackie Robinson played in that park. The Negro Baseball League, it was a huge piece of that. And so when integration happened, what that allowed is it allowed essentially, I think at the time, the city council was all white except for one member, I think. And what that allowed city council to do was really just to wring out their hands like, awesome, now we don't have to support Lincoln Park. And they shut down Lincoln Park. They defunded Lincoln Park and moved all those funds to the white Warner Park, which was now integrated. We lost this incredible historical resource and landmark of the African-American community, not just in Chattanooga, but in the entire South, because of something that was supposed to be progress, but because of the way, the sinister way that white privilege works, we actually lost an incredible cultural resource in the name of progress and integration. That's kind of like a way I try and show people that the way that white privilege and systemic and structural racism kind of works, even here on a local level. Off the top of my head, I know if you study the city in the 1980s, our mayoral system was elected by the city councilors, and our city council was essentially gerrymandered in such a way that you only had at maximum two African-American city council members. So it was impossible to ever have an African-American mayor in Chattanooga, which we still haven't had, but at least now we have a popular election system that was kind of forced upon our city because our city in the 1980s refused to change.
Another example of what's billed as progress, but also brings these consequences that you talk about are roadways.
And I get into this in the podcast. The post-World War II period, I don't know that our country will ever experience the amount of wealth creation that happened ever again. And the ways that we squandered that wealth is just fascinating. In almost every American city, poor and black neighborhoods were targeted for urban renewal projects. The housing in those neighborhoods might have been substandard, but what it effectively did was crush the actual community that existed in those places. And so in Chattanooga, we have very real examples of this. I mean, this comes up several times on the Camp House podcast. If you go back in the archives and we talk about urban planning, but Highway 27, especially the way it cut our downtown in half to completely segregate the west side from downtown, they're actually working to change this now and it's getting better. But like, if you had tried to walk from the west side when the housing projects were built in the 1950s and 60s to downtown, it was so hard. There was basically two ways to do it. One was MLK, which was a massive road, or there, I think there's one undercut near the convention center that wasn't really intended for a pedestrian walk at all. You can interpret it incredibly negatively and say there was an intentional effort to keep the west side out of downtown. And even today, you know, the area we refer to as South Side is not the south side of our city. You know, the real south side of our city is below I-24. But because of these barriers that we've created, it really does hem out some of our African-American and poor neighborhoods from the downtown core. And our roads have been very, very effective barriers to people engaging with the core of our city.
That's true not only here, but in every major city across the country, including some of the ones where I have lived, and that would include New York City and, yes, Minneapolis.
Yeah.
How do you see this moment?
What I think is fascinating about this moment, it's just a really interesting conversation, because if you go back 3 or 4 years ago, Ta-Nehisi Coates now has been a pretty big leader, national leader within the African-American community and the broader community when it comes to this conversation. But 3 or 4 years ago, the conversation was around reparations. right? Like figuring out some form of reparations for what our country has done to the African-American community and the way we've systematically sort of robbed that community of wealth for so many years. But right now, that conversation hasn't happened. And the conversation right now is entirely about defunding the police, right? Or divesting from the police. That's a fascinating difference because I feel like it might be easier to have a conversation around reparations right now. But I think the conversation around divesting from the police is actually a really interesting one. Because when it comes to this example of how do we make progress and ensure that there's not a backlash the way that we see continually happen. So if the goal of this movement right now is to divest from the police in order to invest in Black and brown communities, that is the standard that we have to make sure actually happens from this point forward. Because I think a backlash that could happen is, yes, we divest from the police, but where do those resources actually end up going? Are they actually going to go to invest in our Black and brown communities? I have no idea. Who knows if we'll actually get to that point? Whatever action we take, if we don't have a system of accountability on the back end to make sure that the stated goals actually happen, we could be in big trouble. I don't know this for sure, but like you can go back to the 60s and 70s, and I'm guessing we didn't have systems of accountability in place to make sure of how integration was actually impacting Black and brown communities at that time. We just thought, hey, we did it. Pat ourselves on the back, let's move on. As a white person, what I think we understand now is that that's not always the case, that like there's hard work. You know, I have a friend in a recovery program who knows the day that they get out of their treatment, the hard work really, really begins. And I think the same exact thing is true for us in this moment of whatever it is, you know? So if it is the process of reforming or divesting from our police force, there's so much work to do beyond that. The whole point of that episode too is like, it's not just the police force. Like I think that is an important moment for us to focus on, and we don't need to look away from that. But you know, let's do something about payday lenders in Chattanooga. Love of God, that's such a horrible thing, the way that's taken advantage of our society. Let's make sure that our medical system is taking care of people in a way that doesn't show racial bias. Another resource that I don't mention in there is Racial Equity Institute has something called the Groundwater Study that shows how this topic of systemic and structural racism is equal across sectors, right? It's not just the police and just the system. It's equally there in education. It's equally there in the medical profession, equally there in economics and home loans, even today, even beyond redlining. And so I think we have a ton of work to do, but I think having standards of accountability are going to be huge, whether that's with the police force or whether that's in other systems.
Where can people find the podcast, and where can people go online to follow all that you do at the Camp House?
The podcast can be found on iTunes, anywhere. You know, you can find that episode on our Camp House Facebook page right now. I will say the Camp House is in a huge amount of transition right now. We're in the process of purchasing and owning a new building and moving into it when COVID happened. And so we're kind of in the bit of a lurch. Like, I'm not even sure what our website is right now, if that's even up and accurate because of so many changes that have happened. So we're kind of in a bit of a holding pattern when it comes to the Camp House. But if you like our Facebook page, you can stay up to date with stuff there. And yeah, you can find the podcast on iTunes or wherever, hopefully wherever you get your podcast from.
All right, Matt, thanks so much.
Thank you.